Welcome to The PA Is In, the show created by PAs for PAs, where codependency with your supervising physician is a thing of the past, optimal team practice is the future, and physician associate has taken the place of physician assistant as the professional title of choice. I'm Tracy Bingaman, and I'm obsessed with redefining what success as a PA looks like and what it feels like. Here you'll find the mindset shifts, systems, and processes I use to escape healthcare burnout and integrate my work into my life. Work-life balance is a myth, and an integrated life where you thrive professionally, not a balancing act, is the goal here. My mission is to help you to grow into a unicorn PA who loves their job, has abundant energy, time to spare, and work optional financial freedom. The PA is in. Do you ever feel like talking about death and dying and big, heavy, hard diagnosis with your patients is something that you struggle with? If you are like me and you have stumbled over some of these hard conversations about having talks about what your patients want to do, if their heart stops beating, what their code status is upon admission to the hospital, or even something as simple as who is their medical power of attorney, today's episode is for you. Our guest is my friend, Tracy. Tracy is a palliative care PA, one of only 200 in the country, who has spent the last 23 years of her career prepping to take care of patients as they are navigating terminal illnesses, pain, and she is an expert at talking about death and dying. If that is something that even hearing in this introduction makes you feel a little bit uncomfortable, you're going to want to stay for these tips. Without further ado, here she is, Tracy Paparo. Before we dive in, I want to share with you the review of the week. This review is 5 stars. The title is Empowering and Informative. This reviewer said, Tracy is not only an expert in her field as a healthcare provider, but also in various areas that branch off of that, such as finance, work-life balance, and more. Her podcast is both informative and empowering. As a PA, I had always felt like the field was relatively limiting, but Tracy makes it feel otherwise. Thank you so much, Kate, for taking the time to write this review. If you want a chance for your review to be read next week on the Review of the Week, head to iTunes, leave us a review with some description of what you love or don't love about the show for the opportunity for your review to be chosen as the Review of the Week. Tracy, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm excited.
Really excited about this conversation, especially having seen you speak at the AAPA last year. I just think this topic is so important. So before we get started, tell us a little bit about you and what you do as a PA.
Yeah, so I have been a PA for, well, now you make me count and show my age. It'll be 23 years this year, which is super exciting. I started my career out in emergency medicine, and I think that's what a lot of PAs were doing back then, emergency medicine or surgery, and I took the emergency medicine route. I spent a long time there, about 17, 18 years, and I slowly transitioned to doing some hospitalist work and kind of found my calling between those two things and really worked probably for the last year that I was a hospitalist, like trying to plan how I was going to get my dream PA job, which is inpatient palliative medicine. It's where I belong, and I now can't imagine doing anything else.
So I want you to talk to me about what that year looked like, because I think this career strategy is a missing piece for a lot of providers where they're feeling like, I don't necessarily love where I am, but I don't really have a good method to get to where I think I might want to be. So what did that year of sort of preparation and vying for this position look like?
Yeah, it was rough. You know, it was a little bit of an internal struggle at first too, because it wasn't that I didn't like what I was doing. I enjoyed being a hospitalist. I was working for a good group of docs. I really like my patients, and I've been pretty much in the same hospital system for 20 years. So I'm super familiar with where I was. And was like, oh, I don't necessarily want to leave here, but I so want to do this. And I was doing a lot of it. You know, we'll talk about like primary palliative care skills. Like I was doing a lot of it, but I'm like, I want to do this all the time and more. So it was kind of, you know, that disheartening thing of getting on different places, Indeed, AAPA, different state places, and trying to find postings. And if anybody has looked at jobs in palliative medicine, I will tell you they are all posted for APNs. Nothing against my APN colleagues. I love working with them, but it is an APN heavy specialty. So that was the first hurdle is, okay, how do I prove to these folks that, you know, I'm going to apply for this job? So I did apply for a few, and we had a small team where I was, you know, where I was working, and I just started becoming like their best friend that was probably their annoying little sister. I consulted them. I asked them if I could like sit in on consults with them. I would make sure that if I, you know, if they were coming to see my patients, I was like 100%, I want to partner with you and come to this meeting. And I would just drop little hints like, hey man, if you're ever looking for someone else on the team, you know, keep me in mind. And it was hard because again, I've been at this hospital system. A lot of people knew me and they were like, oh, are you looking for another job? And I'm like, not really. But if it came along, I would definitely have to consider. So it was a lot, especially when, you know, I went to my docs that I was working with when I finally did get an offer and I cried. I was like, listen, and I had kind of warned them and prepped them for it and said, listen, I really like this because they had made comments about, hey, you're doing a lot of this stuff. And I was like, I really enjoy this. If I can find something where I can spend more time doing this, I'm going to take it, but I'm not going to leave you for anything else. So when that day finally came, it was happy and sad at the same time, but I've kind of never looked back. It's been great. I wound up getting hired by the team that I was harassing.
Yeah. Yeah. I have found, I call that pleasant persistence, right? When you just keep showing up and you're just a delight and you are just like their best friend and you make their life easier and you're also like fascinated by what they do. I did that with my current job. I job shadowed probably 2 or 3 days a week to the point where one of my surgeons was like, are we paying you to be here? And I was like, not yet. And then like a couple weeks later, I started my first day and he said, now are we paying you to be here? And I was like, yes, now you are. Because I was just like, I'm not going to leave. I'm just going to be so awesome that they don't want me to ever leave. And they decide to pay me to stay. Awesome. So how long have you been in your position in palliative care?
So doing full-time inpatient palliative is a little over 2 years now, about 2.5 years.
Okay, awesome. So I think this is a subject and a topic that a lot of us don't love and honestly avoid talking to our patients about because it makes us feel uncomfortable. So I would love it if you could share what you love about working in palliative care and what, if you can describe it, a typical day in the life looks like and what it feels like to be sort of front and center with death and dying on a daily basis.
Yeah, that's a big question. So I think that my true love of palliative medicine comes from the fact that I am getting to engage with patients and the people who are important to them at a time where it is oftentimes the hardest thing for them. And I'm able to be that advocate for them, but it's using their own voice and encouraging them to be their own health advocates and embracing that thought of facing a serious illness and death looks different for everyone. You know, I like to say really doing palliative has been the most humbling experience ever because I may have thoughts about tons of things when I read a chart about a patient. And you have to throw that all out the window when you meet that person. It is not like, you know, what I'll say, traditional or regular medicine, where it's like, okay, I'm going to see someone who's febrile and is coughing and oh, grandma probably has pneumonia. I'm just going to walk in there. I'll listen to her lung sounds. I know I'm going to order the antibiotics. I'll check the chest x-ray. You know, what's on paper and what is in front of you when you get there is totally different. And they're bringing all of their life experience with them. And you're bringing yours, but you got to check that at the door because it's not about you. You are simply encouraging them and making them comfortable to use their voice to tell you, not, you know, I say it's people are not sharing with you how they want to die or what, how they think their death is going to be. It's how they want to live. I am giving people the voice to tell others how they want to live the time that they have. So for me, it's been so humbling because no matter what I think about their decision, my job is to just work my butt off to make sure that we accomplish those things. Typical day, we're busy. I will say we're busy in patient service. It's hard. You know, there's palliative medicine in general. I always say I got myself into the PA world, which, you know, we're still relatively young in the whole schema of healthcare professionals. And then I go and pick palliative medicine, which is, you know, literally only been a recognized specialty for less than like 30 years.
Well, someone has to be the pioneer. Someone has to show us how it's done.
And then let alone I'm a PA and there's like less than 200 of us in the entire United States that actually identify as practicing palliative medicine. I'm like, can I find a smaller niche to be in? So typical day, you know, there's, at any given time, I'm trying to think there's four of us probably on the team that are working any given day. We carry anywhere between 25 and 35 patients on our service at a time. But like, for example, sometimes worse than others. Today we have 43 patients on our service. We usually try, we are very good at protecting ourselves as a team. And each other. So we try not to carry more than 10 individually. And we do roughly between 2 and 3 consults a day individually. So that's each of us doing those consults. So we're really dropping like probably between 4 and 6, maybe 7 consults a day. You know, a Monday you come in, you got 12 consults, you're working your tush off. But what those consults mean is, you know, it, again, it's different than what people generally think because you're not just walking in there and, you know, doing a specialty consult focused on one part of the body where you're just like, let me check that thing out and then I'm going to leave. You know, I pull up a chair, I sit down. It's my consults are taking me. If it's an hour, that's normal. If I'm out of there before 45 minutes, it's probably because the patient couldn't tell me anything, or I'm waiting for a family member to come and I'm going to go back later. So a lot of it is just spending time with your patients, digging through the chart and see what's happened and coordinating with that care team. Like care coordination in palliative medicine is huge. We all need to be on the same page. And that's for the benefit of everyone involved, but most importantly, the patients and the folks who care about them, because the message that is shared with the patient and their loved ones needs to be consistent, because that is the only way that people can make the best decision for themselves, is if they're getting consistent information from everyone. You can't have one piece of the pie telling someone, you know, a prognosis or a plan, and then have somebody else come in and just say something completely opposite and then say, okay, what do you decide? You know, that's not fair. So, you know, we do round as a team every morning where we go over every patient. And that's really helpful because, you know, it's myself, a couple of nurse practitioners. We have 2 docs and a social worker on our team. And it's good because you can bounce ideas off of people. I would say 60% of our patients, we are consulted for support and to address goals. The other 40%, we're doing a decent amount of heavy symptom management. You know, we're attached to a regional cancer center, so we are getting really sick patients. We get a lot of symptom management experience, which is awesome. And the ability to just sit there and talk it out with somebody else and be like, am I doing this right? You know, the ability to say, hey, you have 5 minutes. Can you just come and see this patient? Eyeball them for me. Make sure I'm hitting these opioids okay. Is really good. So we're really good about helping each other like that. And then, you know, throughout the day, you're going to have family meetings, and that's going to be the bulk of your day most of the time.
Thinking of a career shift in 2024? Advanced Scope is one of the only PA consulting firms optimizing your job hunt without taking away from your earning potential. They don't dip into your paycheck, and your job search remains 100% confidential at no cost to you. Through partnering with practices nationwide, they know about opportunities before LinkedIn or Indeed even posts them. Connect with their CEO, Madison, today by going to advancedscopetalent.com and booking an exploratory call. Your future career and paycheck will thank you. So I think for all of us working in healthcare, there is a burden on ourselves when we encounter sick patients at the end of their life. And I think for most people, that doesn't happen all day, every day, right? It's a rarity that we get someone who's really at this like actively dying or planning, you know, end of life things. How does that weigh on you as a person? How has that affected the way that you see and live your life?
I think it has overall enriched me to a point that it has made me value things in my own life more and like the little things. But it has also made me really care less about what everybody else thinks and more about, hey, I need to, if this is important to me and I see value in it, I need to be sharing it with other people. Because you see some of these people who are facing a life-limiting illness, who have, you know, strained family relationships, or, you know, have great family relationships, but are just like, holy crap, like I miss doing this, or I wanted to do this. And I'm not even going to call them regrets. It's just, you know, you're going to miss things when you're not here. I have appreciated being more prepared for that. And overall, just talking more to the folks that are important to me. And in that same vein, kind of, and I think going through COVID helped with this too, like really finding who your tribe is. You know, people can, you can think that people are your friends and family, whatever, but find your tribe. But everybody has a reason and a season. And I use that a lot, especially in relation to palliative, with me with my patients, but also me with folks that I interact with outside of work. There's a reason that this person is in your life for a time, and it may only be a season. And that's okay. Maybe that person disappears from your life, but they served a purpose while you were interacting with them. And for me, I think that's what I'm doing with a lot of my patients and families. I'm that reason then, and it's just this season that they're in.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an important reminder for everyone to think about savoring the moments that we're living in, right? Because no moment other than the one that we're living in is guaranteed. And medicine reminds us of that every day, right? We see things happen to people and we think, oh my gosh, this is someone that reminds me of someone that I love or someone that I see myself reflected in. And those cases for me are the ones that are most poignant that I can remember 10 years later. Like, oh, this patient that, you know, reminded me of my sister, my mother, my aunt, myself, that I saw myself in them. And I thought, you know, if this happened to me, would I feel good about the things that I had said and done in my life up until the point where this thing happened? No.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a lot.
Yeah. So the majority of people listening are obviously not primarily in palliative care because there's only 199 others other than you in the country. So for that person who is in primary care, who is inpatient, who is, you know, taking care of people who obviously have serious illness but isn't on a palliative care service, what can we tell that person about what they should be covering when they're talking to their patients about things like advanced care planning? I'm sure you could talk about this for an hour, but
I know, you know, I can. I'm going to break it up into two separate parts. So, you know, there's advanced care planning, which is appropriate for every single person who lives and breathes, right? And then the other side of that is when you get to the point of having been diagnosed with either a serious illness or, you know, to the point where you're developing frailty, elderly, multiple comorbidities, and that's when you start having more of the poignant goals of care type conversations. So advanced care planning in general, I think, is appropriate for any PA in any practice to be addressing to some extent. Of course, I'm going to lean on my, you know, primary care folks and family med folks that it's like, hey man, you guys got to be doing this. But anybody can address it, because you can simply say to any patient that walks in, whether they are 18 years old or 118 years old, hey, if you can't talk to me, who's your person that gets to make a decision? Do you have a healthcare proxy? Number one important question that if I can teach that to anybody, not just healthcare providers, but just the general public, it is the most important thing to be protecting yourself with. Do not take for granted that people will figure it out. Do not assume, oh, I'm married, my husband's just going to make all my decisions. If that's what you want, that's great. I would still recommend writing it down. But what if you don't want your husband making decisions? What if you want your best friend to make decisions? Then write that down. What if something happens to you and your husband at the same time and you both can't talk? Who's your alternate person? I mean, you can only plan for so many scenarios, but that's an example. So that I think is appropriate for anybody. Dermatologists, you know, people walk in there for a skin check. Hey, do you have a healthcare proxy? Can we know? Because, you know, when we're looking for people's healthcare proxies, I'll dig through everything I could find. So that's, and remember, every state is different. You know, I'm in New Jersey. We have some really bizarre next of kin laws. It's not like that in every state. So you just make sure what your state rules are. So that's number one. The other side of advanced care planning is not only who's your healthcare proxy, but hey, you know, have you thought about a living will, or what, you know, what people refer to as a living will, which is advanced care directives? That's where people start thinking about and having conversations of, what if something bad happens to me? What if I am in a situation where I die? Do I want to be resuscitated? You know, how far do I want to go to try and get better? And what does better look like? Listen, most people under the age of probably 65, 70 are never going to think about this and are not going to do it. But it's worth talking about, is what I tell people. And the more that people hear it from their clinicians that are taking care of them, the more likely they are to be like, you know what, I'm just going to look into this, because the next time I go back to see PA Tracy, I want to be able to tell her I did it already. Stop asking me. Right?
Okay. Question about code status on an acute standpoint. So I did general surgery for years, and we would be admitting like young, healthy, 33-year-old male with appendicitis, right? He's coming into the hospital to get his appendix out. And unfortunately, he has no medical problems, so I can't make medicine admit him. So I am admitting him as the surgery provider. And so, so I'm doing the admission orders. And of course, I never ask it when I'm in the room the first time. And it says code status. So then This is such a faux pas, and I want to tell you what I used to do so you can tell me what I should be doing instead. So I'm still in the ER charting, and I go, oh shoot, code status. And I stick my head back in the room and I say, hey Fred, if your heart stops, do you want us to resuscitate you? I swear, this is a phrase that I have used. And he's like, what? And sometimes if I wasn't in a hurry, I would say, you know, we don't think anything's going to go wrong. We're going to take great care of you. But if your heart stops, do you want us to save you? But I didn't have a good phrase. And I think I was always uncomfortable asking the question. So I think I made my patients feel uncomfortable answering the question. So how can we ask acute code status for admission in a way that makes people feel not like they're going to die while they're there?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's very unique to the situation. You know, the one that you're talking about is totally different than the 89-year-old that you're admitting for an aspiration pneumonia, who maybe is only on high flow right now, but you're not sure what's going to happen, right? Maybe you're putting them in like an intermediate bed or something. I think, and that's a good question. I had to think about it a little bit. I think in that situation, it is a good opportunity. Number one, who's your healthcare proxy, right? Because you're putting someone under anesthesia, make sure who the healthcare proxy is. And then again, what I tell people when we talk about code status is our jobs as clinicians, we do it every day and don't realize it. But we say, I have to say it when I talk about code status, is make a recommendation. You know, think about it. People come and see us all the time. A doc, PA, I don't feel good. Can you just do something? Yeah, I recommend you go take, you know, some sinus cleanse or something, or here, take these antibiotics. But then when it comes to something as catastrophic as CPR, we're just like, do you want that? But no one says, do you want metoprolol or amlodipine for your blood pressure? So to me, in that situation, I, you know, especially in a surgical thing, I would present it as, listen, anything could happen when we are touching the human body. I hope that nothing happens, but worst case scenario, bad things can happen. You may come out of the OR unable to talk to us. Worst case would be something would happen and your heart would stop. Given your history and what I can see that you've shared with me and what procedure you're going to go through, you do have a choice, but my recommendation would be at this point, we would leave things what is called a full code. The other option would be to have something like a DNR in place. And I always ask people when I say that, do you know what that means? Because people have such bizarre concepts of what those words mean. But again, as a recommendation, because you go in there and say, you want to stay full code, right? How do they know that? Because they've never thought about that before, because no one's ever asked them.
Yep. Also guilty of making that assumption because people are young and healthy, right? So I have biases that I probably am still, you know, don't even see because I'm living inside of my own head. But I would, yes, I would go in and just say like, well, this guy's young and healthy. Like he wants to be a full code. Like we have to ask, and it's okay to make a recommendation. I never thought about that. I always was just like, you want it? You know, like, tell me what you want. I'll put it in the computer.
Yeah. There's been interesting podcasts and talks about the linguistics of it. And I'm terrible with names. So like, I wish I was one of those people who could say, oh, I listened to this podcast and it was Dr. So-and-so and I can't. So I'm sorry if I'm stealing like somebody's thunder because this is what they said on a podcast. It's the difference between like, what do people want and what do they need? No one ever needs to have CPR done. The question is, would that be in line with what they would want if you were able to ask them? You know, so that would be my recommendation for that surgical person. And then, you know, going back to your whole advanced care planning and then further on, once people are diagnosed with any serious illness, and I want to qualify that because people always think palliative care, oh, you see all the cancer patients, or, oh my goodness, you must just take care of like terrible ALS patients, or all those awful brain dead people, like awful, like I've heard awful things
like
come
worst,
from
like the worst
uneducated folks. Yes. Yes. And honestly, I want to make clear that any serious illness at any stage qualifies someone for the support of palliative medicine. There are plenty of people who are followed by palliative medicine and quote, graduate off of our service. You know, especially on the outpatient side, there are plenty, listen, we know there are plenty of cancers that are treated aggressively, patients tolerate treatment, and they get to no evidence of disease. We love those patients. But it doesn't mean that they didn't deserve the support of palliative addressing their quality of life while they were receiving chemo and or radiation or immunotherapy, that we didn't aggressively manage the symptoms that we knew they were going to have from these treatments. And yes, I'm picking on cancer, but oncologists do that, right? Folks that practice oncology do that, but they're also doing all the other things. So we can help with that. You know, heart failure patients, end stage renal disease patients, I'm trying to think, stroke, dementia, you know, dementia is huge. That's the advantage of having palliative on board. I'd rather meet a patient and I don't want to say have to do nothing for them, but I'd rather just be the person who's like, hey, how are you today? You know, and have them be like, today was a great day. That's awesome. I don't want to have to prescribe anything. I don't want to have to tell them to take another pill. But you know what? 3 weeks from now, when they're having this debilitating nausea and they're constipated because they're needing to take pain meds, I want them to be able to call me and be like, hey, remember 3 weeks ago, I was feeling so good. Today's a really crappy day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel like palliative care is the one service that actually wants you to call them. Which is like, I'm saying like a little bit tongue in cheek, but also you're like, please consult us, like call us. You can't call us too early. You can't call us too often. Like call us. We'll tell you if it's not appropriate. Right. Like we'll tell you.
I don't think I ever thought about it that way.
Right. You're like, call us. Really, everyone else is like, don't call us. Like, never.
And I never thought about it that way, especially like coming from the ER, because I mean, as surgery, like how many times you get a phone call and it's like, I'm sorry, you're my third call. Will you admit the patient? And it's like, nope, not going to do it. Call somebody else. And I'm down there begging the ER, like, listen, when these people come in, can you please just pick up the phone and call me first? Because we want to get on top of this.
Sure. Before they go. So do you find that you have to run interference between well-intentioned healthcare providers and your patients? So say your patient has expressed, you know, I don't want to consider surgery or aggressive intervention. But the surgery team, you know, smells that they're there and are bored and that, and they're like, hey, I'm a surgeon. I like to cut things open. I like to cut them off. And do you have to say, no, they've said they don't want this? Cause I'm imagining that might happen.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it becomes a very nuanced conversation. But, you know, from our perspective as palliative folks, you know, you think about the like tenets of ethics, right? Patient autonomy. Like, again, it goes back to that humbling experience of this may not be the decision that I would make, but what I can ensure is that the patient has all of the appropriate information. I tell people all the time, my job is to give you all of the good information. You're not making a right or wrong answer. You're making the best one for yourself because there's no one like you. So if that best answer for you, then you tell me, and then I need to make sure that everybody else respects that. It does get difficult sometimes because listen, other specialties, even, you know, primary care folks, hospitalists, anybody in healthcare, think about it. We went to school and it was like, we're going to teach her how to fix these things. And we came out and we were like, we are going to be fixers and make it all better. And this is going to be awesome. And I'm going to be so happy when I go home from work every day. And then here comes someone like me saying, we don't have to fix that. We could leave it alone. You know, it goes back to the whole thought of the idea of death being seen as failure. Death isn't failure. And I'm going to steal a line from Jen O'Brien. See, I can remember her name. She very rightfully says the only thing that is 100% correct 100% of the time is death. It's coming for everyone. It's just a matter of when it happens. So, you know, I think a lot of times we don't, interference, I think was a good word that you used. I've never thought about it that way. Again, I look on the side of we tell consultants in my hospital, a lot of times the word that we use is like, let's stop having siloed conversations with the patient and let's go in together. Because I am quite honestly, a lot of times the only one who will say to the patient, what is important to you? Let them answer that. And then say to the surgeon, oncologist, cardiologist, you know, CCU doctor, whoever is standing there, now that you hear what's important, how are we going to make that happen? Because maybe what's important to them is not going to be possible if they have this huge surgery, or maybe it is. You know, a lot of times it is. People want to go through these massive undertakings, and the best we can do is prepare them for best and worst case scenario, and then just be there for them on the other side.
Most PAs bring home a decent paycheck, but aren't sure that they're investing enough or what approach to take for student loans. Kayla Pepperday is a certified financial planner who works specifically with APPs. Seeing that PAs, including his wife, were overlooked and physicians were treated with respect in the financial planning industry, he sought to rectify this mismatch by serving PAs with the excellence we deserve. Caleb's mission is to help make financial planning affordable for APPs regardless of their asset level. Head to advancedpracticeplanning.com and hit the schedule a conversation button to book your free consult. Your money is your largest wealth building tool, and failing to utilize it well could leave you wanting to retire without enough in your accounts or still having student loan payments when your kids are ready to attend college themselves. Caleb's clients can enjoy their money guilt-free while feeling confident in their savings and investments. Head to the show notes, tap the link, and call Caleb for your free consultation. On the call, Caleb will help you to determine whether his one-time or ongoing financial planning services are right for you. Yeah, and I think, you know, an important reminder for everyone listening is just because we can doesn't mean that we should. And that we should is we should respect our patient's wishes. We should take the time to ask them. So if you're taking care of a patient somewhere where they don't have a strong palliative care team, or where palliative care can't get to you and can't get to the patient, it's 2 a.m., you know, we have to emergently decide, right? Because like you're saying, we come in on Monday and there's lots of consults. And you know what my surgery brain thought? Well, that woman perfed her bowel at 2 a.m. on Saturday night, right? Like, I'm like, so these things don't always happen necessarily with the support of a patient, calm palliative care provider in the room. So what are some tips we can take away when we walk in to have that conversation with grandma and her family at 2 a.m. because she is ill and could potentially need an intervention that could save her life, but might prolong her suffering? How can we cage that discussion in a way of like, I feel uncomfortable, you know, this is a high stress situation, but we have to talk about it and we have to figure out what we're going to do in the moment.
Yeah. I think, you know, first off, practice. As much you're afraid of doing it, but just keep doing it. And even if, you know, you're with somebody and they're going to do it, just go with them and listen, because you're going to pick up tips from other people. So that first off. But the other thought would be, you know, there's a lot to be said for walking in a room and reading the room. There's an energy in the room when somebody is sick, you know, those high stress environments and the patient, you know, you're dealing with someone that this is the worst day that they have ever had for the most part. And this is, you know, routine for you, right? Read the room. My number one is always to make sure that the patient has another person. If there's no one physically there, I really, really get agitated when people don't say, hey, do you want to pick up the phone and call somebody else? Because four ears are always better than two. You're talking to someone who is feeling miserable, and now you're asking them to make these ridiculously large decisions. So I always offer. People may say no, that's fine. Always, and if there are people there or they ask you to call somebody, always identify who they are and speak to your audience. Remember, it is not me and you talking. You know, you can't stand there and say your mom has perfed her bowel and we need to do this surgery because we need to take out 10 centimeters of her jejunum. And they don't care about that. You know, you have to, I don't want to use the term like dumb it down, but we're all really smart. We went and graduated from PA school, right? But just think about how would you want someone to talk to your family and do that and take a deep breath. And that's where my other recommendation comes in. When you start feeling uncomfortable, like you are talking too much, stop and pause. Ask the patient if they have questions. And then pause again. And when you start feeling uncomfortable because nobody's talking, keep pausing. That was a huge learning curve for me. I am a talker. I grew up in Brooklyn. I came from the ER where things never stop. And it was hard for me. I mean, there are times that I am sitting on my hand. I'm biting my tongue. I'm counting to 25. I'm doing a grocery list because I'm like, that when you pause, it is amazing what will come out. People need time to process things. We want things so fast. People can't process the information we're giving them that fast. You got to give them time. But it's just the language that you use, you know, respectful, person first language that is empowering them to make the best decision for themselves. and always ask if they have questions, because it's remarkable how many people I talk to that they're like, I wanted to ask the surgeon this, but then they just left. And I'm like, well, why didn't you stop them? And it's like, well, I figured they were busy.
They are, but it's still important. Yeah. That is so interesting to hear you say, because we have met in person and I find you to be very calm and I feel like your cadence of talking and answering questions is very like, oh, I'm like, I should slow down and I want to be more like Tracy when I grow up.
I think it goes through my head so fast. I feel like that's how it comes out. But I will say these 2 years, like besides the whole like thought of it being humbling, I have taken a lot of time to just think about how my voice is coming across to other people. I also tend, you know, my husband will hear me and probably scream from the other room that I'm correct. I tend to be very loud. My tone can change, but I'm a volume person. So when I get excited or there's something that I'm really into, my volume goes up. And when you're sitting talking to a patient, maybe, you know, a person who has cancer or heart failure and their family sitting there, and you can't be yelling at them. You know, the calmer that you can be, the more that they are going to appreciate what you're saying to them. And always, always sit down, please. Find some place to sit, even if it's on the garbage can. Don't stand on top of your patient and just be talking over to them, because it's like you're giving them directions and they don't have a choice, right? How many times do patients say, I didn't know I had another choice? Sitting down has been proven to change the entire feel of the room.
Yeah, for sure. And when you were saying that and you were saying, you know, we have to explain it at a level that our patients are going to understand. I can remember very clearly from PA school, someone saying your average patient is going to have a third grade reading level. And I remember thinking, third grade? When I was in the third grade, I read, you know, the Magic Treehouse books, right? So I'm thinking like, what, you know, what level? And I now, as a parent of a third grader, I'm like, oh, like how would I explain to him what's happening with the bowel perforation, right? Like, well, there's a tube and there's a hole and that's bad. And the stuff that goes in it shouldn't be on the outside. It should be on the inside. Like, right? It would be very different than how I would pick up the phone and call my surgeon and explain a bowel perf for free air or, you know, whatever. So as we're kind of talking about that and talking about children specifically, this is a very self-serving question. One of my kids is obsessed with dying. Obsessed. Like we talk about death and dying in our household with this particular child on a daily basis. Like she will ask me when I'm going to heaven and who is next up to die in our family. So can you give us some tips on how to approach this with our own families, whether that be our kids or parents or, you know, how we can talk about death and dying? Because I think as the healthcare person, we are sort of the authority on this thing, whether we want to be or not.
This is a great question. I feel like it's so loaded. First off, I think just the big movement in society in general has to be to just normalize death and dying, right? It needs to be something that we can all talk about and it's not scary, because quite frankly, again, it is the only thing that literally happens to all of us. Like no one is going to be able to avoid dealing with death in some capacity, whether it's somebody that you love, somebody that you know, somebody that you watch die, somebody that you've heard of died. We all know it. What is amazing, and you know, I love hearing when you talk about your daughter, is kids have no filter and they will talk about it and they don't even realize that this isn't how adults talk about it. So to me, you know, that should totally be encouraged. Like, kudos to you. Sit down, talk about it. Like, I would like to give her a hug and be like, why can't the adults talk like this? You know, it goes back to the whole idea that when you're talking to a patient about their end of life journey, you know, I use that term a lot. That's your end of life journey. You know, we want to work towards making it a compassionate and dignified journey. But there are times, it's that reading the room, right? That you're talking to a family or loved ones, and you got to use the die word. Patients and people who love them worry all the time about, how am I going to tell the kids? What am I going to tell the kids? My advice is always, the kids know. It's like pets. I feel like they're like dog. I'm a dog person, so I think the cats are probably pretty astute too. But like dogs, they know when something weird's going on, right? Kids know, they're not stupid. Lots of times they're just waiting for you to tell them what's happening. They may ask some questions, but for the majority of the time, they're just waiting and they're kind of observed. They are masters of observation. So I tell people all the time, the kids know what's going on. You have to be honest with them. And, you know, I say this for adults, but more for kids. You cannot use euphemisms. You have to use that word die, as it's more scary for you than it is for them. You got to let them talk about this stuff. And I always say, you know, especially we experienced the death of my mother-in-law last year. And that was for my two kids, that was their first like personal experience with death. Granted, they have a mom who comes home and talks about it all the time. We are very open in my house talking about this stuff. You know, my husband's a firefighter, you know, and was a first responder before that. And we talk about all sorts of things that other people would probably say were inappropriate. So my kids have been exposed to tons of that. But now it was like, holy crap, this is like in our house now. You know, this is in our world. They were amazing. And they are the ones that, quite frankly, have kept her alive since she died last year. They talk about her like she's still here. They say, oh, grandma would love if we did that. Oh, imagine if we could call grandma and tell her we did that. You know, oh, we'll be walking through a store and she inevitably collected things. And it was like, oh, grandma would buy that thing. It should be cherished that they are so okay with doing it. And they should be an example for all of us, because they're doing it way better. And whatever we can do to not make them become the adults that won't talk about it, we just got to keep doing.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I would say this obsession has been going on for a while. So at first I was very taken off guard. Like I didn't, oh, okay, we're just driving to the grocery store. We're on our way to daycare. It's just part of life. And she'll say, when are you going to heaven? Like, it's just like someplace you go. I'm like, well, hopefully not for a long time, but we never really know, right? And she has just this genuine curiosity where she's asking questions. And she has this notion, which we have since debunked and sometimes re-emerges, that people die in the order that they're born. So she had... like she had specifically asked, which of my grandfathers is older? And I told her, and she said, so he's next. and I said, well, it's possible, you know, but it doesn't actually, it's not birth order. It's not the same as death order, without freaking her out and saying, well, sometimes kids die before their parents, right? So keeping it.
Like, I think the it's important to be honest, but like age appropriate honesty, where it's great. Like, we know that that's not right. People don't die in birth order. So no, you know, just like you said, no, honey, that's not exactly right. However, yes, some people are older than other people and it is, you know, more likely that they get sicker and die. But, you know, the other important thing that I always encourage when talking about this with kids is that we always make very clear that when people are dying, that they will be comfortable and they're going to be surrounded by love. And especially when folks are in the hospital, you know, I get a lot of young cancer patients, and these are the ones that tear at your heartstrings. What we're always very clear about is mommy or daddy or grandma, grandpa, whoever it is, you know, they are safe and there are really good people taking care of them. All you need to do is really love them. You know, we're really big, especially now, thank God, like once the COVID things kind of relax, like we're really good about trying to get kids in no matter what age they are, at least for a small visit if we have to. And that can be really anxiety provoking for families and staff. You know, we're palliating everybody when this happens. you know, and there are nurse managers that will get angry at you and they're like, I don't think they should be coming in. And I said, no, it's not our decision to make. It's their parents, but it's ultimately the child. You know, we have to give them a lot of credit. You know, I always recommend to people, you know, they'll say, should I bring my daughter in to see their father? And I said, why don't you go home and ask them? You know, ask them if they want to see dad, but be very honest. And now with the dawn, you know, with FaceTime, it's great. Cause I'm like, have you been FaceTiming? Cause then she knows what he looks like. You know, maybe he looks really bad and she knows that. But if she's comfortable coming in to see him, we're going to encourage that, because for the patient, it's going to mean the world. People's entire demeanors change just when they're able to spend 15 minutes surrounded by that kid, because it is pure understanding there. And they are just so open to everything. And I will say, I have never seen a kid break down from fear. They are the most resilient human beings ever. And we should all just learn from what they're doing. But the biggest thing is honesty. You know, you let your daughter talk about it. You're like, oh my goodness, no, we don't talk about that. Like, no, we have to.
Yeah. You know, and I think both as parents and as providers, there are always questions that people are going to ask us that we were not expecting, and we're not quite, well, I've never thought of that, or I don't actually know, but I can find out, right? So there's a whole lot of skills that I use at work that I also use at home, because I also have sons that ask me, how does the jet engine's combustion work? And I say, well, I don't know, but we can Google it, right? We can look it up. I'm not sure. You know, it's an important reminder that none of us knows everything, right? And we're doing the best we can with the information that we have. So awesome. Well, I think this is just going to resonate so much with our listeners. And there's going to be something for everyone in this episode where they're like, yes, I can remember to sit down in a room. Yes, I can remember that these conversations are hard, but that we can do hard things. So if someone is listening and they're saying, hey, I want more of Tracy in my life, I want to follow what she's doing, I want to hear her speak at the AAPA this year, where can they go to find all the things about you?
Yeah. So first I will say, I listened to your prior episode recently. So I'm on LinkedIn.
Yay!
Tracy Pizarro. I have everything updated. I'm trying my best. I am on Facebook with my name, but that's mostly a lot of my kids stuff. Where I share a lot of palliative musings is on Instagram. It's your palliative PA, but it's your.palliative_PA. Because Lord knows I tried every iteration of it, and that was the only one that was apparently available. I don't know where all these other palliative PAs are, but they're not on Instagram that I can find. I try and share some tips on there, you know, really good primary palliative skill things, and really good tips for just, you know, if you're thinking about this stuff, this is where you could go get more information. By all means, please do not ever hesitate to send me a message. Contact me on LinkedIn. I get back to everyone. And I'm happy to always curbside advice a little bit, kind of point you in the right direction, and just generally talk about anything related to this.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for sharing your time and your wisdom with us today.
Awesome. Thank you.
I love any conversation that reminds us that sometimes we have to be bad at stuff before we can get good at stuff, mainly practicing having these discussions with our patients, even when we feel uncomfortable, even when we think we might be making them feel uncomfortable, that practice makes progress, and that bringing up these things and starting to talk to your patients about death and dying, which is truly the only inevitability for everyone listening to this show. Talking about these things helps patients to have a venue to share their thoughts and their desires, and for people to really take death and dying from something that is to be feared to something that is to be savored, and that it's about the journey, not the destination, because honestly, we are all headed to the same place. Thank you, as always, for tuning in to another episode of The PA Is In. If this episode resonated with you, if you felt like this advice was helpful, head on over to iTunes, leave us a review, screenshot and tag me at Mrs. Tracy Bingaman or tag Tracy on social media. Send this episode to a friend in a text or an email to help us spread the word so that we can have more providers get comfortable talking about death and dying. That's all for today. I'll see you next time. This PA is out. Congratulations. You've just joined an awesome club. By listening to a full episode of The PA Is In, you are officially on the Unicorn PA team. Welcome aboard. What most team members do is they subscribe to the podcast because that allows them to automatically get the latest episode of the show. The life of your dreams exists on the other side of taking action. Keep making small shifts and keep getting better. Your life will improve, your career will soar, and you will have the confidence you need to create your own success. I will see you in the next episode. This PA is out.